I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. A new report from the Able Foundation found that there are more than 1,400 young people under the age of 25 who don't have a place to call home or a parent or guardian to look out for them. Despite these alarming numbers, there are very few facilities in Baltimore that cater to the needs of the most vulnerable among us. So what's being done to help these kids, and why are they on the streets? We'll meet a remarkable young college student named Danny Jones, who experienced homelessness for most of his childhood, but now counsels young people living in similar circumstances. We'll also talk to Megan Lucy, who wrote the ABLE report, and Lara Law, the program director for Youth Empowered Society, the only drop-in center for homeless youth in the city. To be young and homeless, Midday starts right after the news. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. This is the time of year when we gather with our families and reflect on the things that we're thankful for. The comfort of hearth and home is alluded to and embedded in many of the traditions of the season. And it's going to be 20 degrees in Baltimore tomorrow morning, and for the thousands of people living on the streets in Baltimore, the holidays are the time when temperatures drop and beds in homeless shelters become even more scarce than usual. According to a new report from the Able Foundation and Youth Reach Maryland, more than 1,400 of the people in Baltimore living without homes are young people. They're under the age of 25. They are often without their parents, a stable place to sleep, and access to food. 1,400 is a lot higher than the number of homeless youth previously reported back in 2011, when they reported about 640 young people being homeless. Many of these kids stay with friends and sometimes strangers until they wear out their welcome. Some live on the streets or in abandoned buildings. And despite the alarming number of unaccompanied homeless young people, there are very few shelters and service providers that focus specifically on the needs of kids. Megan Lucy is a freelance journalist who wrote a report on youth homelessness for the Able Foundation. It's called No Place to Call Home. She joins us on the line from the studios of KUCI in Irvine, California. Megan Lucy, welcome to Midday.
Thanks for having me.
Lara Law is the program director at Youth Empowered Society, or YES. That organization runs the city's only drop-in center geared towards young people. She's here with me in the studio. Lara, am I pronouncing your name right? Lara or Lara?
Lara.
Lara. All right. Well, thanks. Welcome to the show. And Danny Jones is here as well. He's 21 years old and a sophomore psychology major at Morgan State University. He experienced homelessness during most of his childhood. Danny, it's terrific to meet you.
Thank you. Same to you.
So, you know, Danny, when I use the term you experienced homelessness, I suppose that's true, right? But it sounds awfully antiseptic. It sounds awfully academic almost. I mean, tell me what that experience really entailed. How old were you when you became homeless?
Okay, my first experience with homeless when I was 8 years old. Yes.
And what kind of family do you have? How many brothers and sisters do you have?
Oh, man, I have 6 brothers and 7 sisters, all from the same mother, 14 overall.
14 kids. And where are you in that
order? I'm the very last. My twin died at birth.
Oh,
yes.
Wow. So, like, really, right out of the gate, man.
It's
crazy. You had some stuff happening.
Yeah.
So you're 8 years old. Were you with your mom at that point when you guys were homeless?
Yes, when I first started experiencing homelessness, I was with my mom.
And were others of your brothers and sisters with her as well?
Yeah, like 3 other brothers. 2 of my brothers and 1 of my sisters.
So there's 4 of you and your mom.
Yes.
And you didn't have any place to call home at 8. You were 8 and the others were a little bit older.
Yes.
And so where did you stay?
Around 8 or just through the time.
Well, and you sort of consider yourself no longer homeless by about age 16, something like that?
Yes.
All right. All right, so for those 8 years, I mean, tell us the kinds of places you were staying at, how you would address that immediate need every day.
Oh, man, that's a good question. So the first place I used to stay with family members because I was young and I couldn't do anything without my mom. So I would stay with family members. Sometimes we would go to shelters. Sometimes we would sleep on a bus stop. Sometimes, you know, and she would just take me over to people's house and just leave me there for probably like a day or something. This is when I was like younger, like eight through like 11. You know, when I started getting a little older and, you know, the stuff started weighing on me, like mentally and physically, because I was in school and I would have to move so much that I was, you know, making bonds with people and, you know, being drained because I was being taken away from them. And sometimes I was being
brought back. Because you'd be having to go to different schools when you would move to a different, like a relative place or something.
Exactly.
You know? And what about your dad?
My dad, he left around like 12.
You were 12 years old?
Yeah, he just...
So you had been in touch with him a little bit early on?
Yeah, early, just until about like, around that age, about like 12.
Mm-hmm. And I understand your dad passed away?
Yep, on Mother's Day.
How old were you then?
That was this year.
Oh, this year?
Yeah.
Oh, so he was just this year, wow.
Yeah.
And you're 21 now?
Yes. Uh-huh.
How about your mom? How's she doing?
Honestly, as the cycle continues.
So she's had some stuff to deal with, huh?
Yes.
Like drugs, alcohol,
yes.
That kind of stuff?
I'm just figuring out that she's dealing with drugs. At first I thought it was all alcoholism, but it's drugs too.
Are you in touch with her?
Yes, every day.
Every day?
Yes, sir.
And how about your brothers and sisters? You in touch with them?
Yes. Kind of, sort of. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you're at Morgan now?
Yes.
And where are you living now?
I'm living in Thurgood Marshall.
Which is the dorm at Morgan.
Yeah, it's like an apartment dorm.
Right.
Thing.
And you can stay there. What about the summers when school's not happening?
I probably just like one of my peers.
So you got some folks that you can crash with for the summer.
Yes.
And like Christmas vacation coming up, you know, a lot of folks leave. You mm-hmm. know, obviously the classes. I understand you got your one last final today. Huh?
Yes.
Oh, well, thanks for taking the time to come in. You got a final as soon as you leave here. You got 2 hours and got to take a final. Mm-hmm. But then classes are over, so you can stay over the Christmas holiday.
Yes.
And they got meal plan and everything still going mm-hmm. into. Yeah. Megan Lucy, you wrote this report for the Able Foundation, and the study upon which this report is done is based on research done by folks at the Institute for Innovation and Implementation at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, this thing called Youth Reach Maryland. Can you describe how they got the information that they got? How was the study conducted? How did they come up with this number of 1,421 homeless youth under the age of 25 on the streets of Baltimore?
Sure. So the Youth Reach Maryland efforts are the most comprehensive efforts for counting and identifying youth homelessness in Maryland and Baltimore City to date. And it started actually from legislation in 2014 that established the pilot program in six jurisdictions across Maryland. And the folks at the Institute for Innovation and Implementation at University of Maryland and the steering committee have been integral in terms of both doing the initial research and planning for the survey process and then the process of actually coordinating and implementing the survey that took place across six jurisdictions. It took place over about 6 weeks in September through October of 2015. While there is the steering committee and the folks at the University of Maryland School of Social Work who are coordinating the efforts, a lot of the success for the Youth Reach Maryland efforts are due to extensive local planning efforts and the engagement of youth in terms of developing the survey tool, working with young people to identify and create magnet events to conduct outreach to young people who might be experiencing homelessness in their communities.
Because if you're going to count them, you got to know where they are, right?
Exactly.
I mean, how do you find out where they are? How did the researchers know where to go? Are they confident that this number they have is an accurate number? Do you think it's low? Do you think it's... right? What do you think?
I think by definition, youth who are experiencing homelessness are a highly disconnected population that often either don't want to identify as being homeless or don't realize that their housing status qualifies them as being homeless or having housing instability. So, like I said, the Youth Reach Maryland data is the most comprehensive data we have because of the extensive local coordination and implementation and youth engagement. But I do think that any data we have to date will still significantly underestimate the full extent of youth that are experiencing homelessness in Baltimore and Maryland.
And Danny, you're giving an amen to that. I mean, in terms of young kids not wanting to tell anybody that they're homeless, that's a real issue. You went through that as well, huh?
Yes. If this was around the time that I was homeless and I was dealing, and I was still going through like the mental, you know, like issues, that was it was hard for me to even talk about it. It was like trying to do this interview right now. If I was around that, if this is the same time, I wouldn't have done it.
Mm-hmm. You just sort of shut down.
Yeah, because it's kind of shameful, you know what I'm saying? It's like just to know, you know, just to be in a room full of people who can't relate exactly like with homelessness and you know, kind of feel like you're like, damn, this is, I feel for you, you know what I'm saying? It's like kind of pity. So it's bad. Even though it's not how you guys are actually looking at it, it's a shameful feeling. It's just like being naked in a room with people with clothes.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, you're in the seventh grade or something, you know, and everybody else you're hanging with in the lunchroom, you know, exactly. They got mom at home or sometimes a mom and dad, whomever, and they got a place to go after school. You're sitting there thinking, well, where am I going tonight after school?
Man, I swear, like, it was so many times, like in the cafeteria, kids used to tell me about their mom, their dad, and what they got for Christmas. And it was so crazy. I had to develop like acting skills because it was out of that or just flee, you know what I'm saying? And I always had a strong will, so I wasn't going to just run, just flee. So I had to, you know, come up with some stuff and, you know, and even after that, I would have to come up with more stuff because I couldn't, you know, it didn't make sense at the end. Like, oh man, I got this. My mom, dad, hey, what your dad got you? You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
It's like, he got me a new, pillow, yeah. Hello.
yeah. Danny Jones is a sophomore at Morgan State University. He and his family were homeless for much of his childhood from about age 8 to age 16. When you say you have a strong will, Danny, I bet you do.
Yes, sir.
And Lara Law, at the drop-in center that you run just up the street from WIPR here in Charles Village, tell us the kinds of kids you're talking to there, when you're open, the services that you offer, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So we work with 14 through 25-year-olds who are homeless and on their own. They are homeless for a variety of reasons, systems failures and family breakdown and poverty.
What do you mean by systems failures? What does that mean?
I mean, foster care. Most of the youth have been, or many of the youth have been involved in foster care in the justice system, and those systems didn't help them transition into stability. And sometimes they're in those systems and they don't feel safe, and so they're running away from them and seeking services.
So when they drop in at Youth Empowerment Society, what happens then?
So they come seeking support. They seek respite. They come to meet basic needs, food, clothing, hygiene products. Many come in and want to go to sleep. And they first meet those basic needs and also the need for community. And because we sit down at a dining room table together and people eat and we celebrate people's birthdays. People get their mail there. They wash up in our bathrooms. And through that process, our case managers and our staff, which is comprised of both people who've experienced homelessness, young adults that have experienced homelessness, and allies like myself, we support them, we build relationships with them, and through those relationships where they come to trust us, we work on helping them get stable, everything from getting into the immediate shelter need, if that's what they're open to that permanent housing, to their own apartment, to a job at Starbucks, to keeping that job. We work with youth for 6 months after they get housed. We graduate them after that point. But we know that youth need support over the long haul.
And Megan Lucy, in your report, you talk about sometimes the even basic difficulty of defining homelessness. There's something called Category 1 homelessness, which means that only people who live in a place not meant for human habitation, or an emergency shelter or transitional housing or a hotel paid for by a government or a charitable organization, That's how they define category one homelessness. And if you're not defined like that, you're often not eligible for services that government and charitable organizations could offer. Is that right?
That's right. I do think the definition of youth homelessness or youth who might be experiencing housing instability is really an important thing that needs to be continued to be refined as we move forward and made more consistent. The federal definition of Category 1 homelessness, most service providers receive funding from HUD for Category 1 funding, which limits their services to the definition that you just said, which is a fairly restrictive category. But we do know from the Youth Reach Maryland data and the experiences of youth and service providers in Baltimore City that that definition really doesn't capture the full experience of homelessness and housing instability for young people in Baltimore. And the other problem with the limiting services to the Category 1 is that it limits services, more preventive services, because it's only for young people or individuals who are currently experiencing homelessness. There needs to be a greater prevention efforts as well.
Megan Lucy is the author of a report released just last month by the ABLE Foundation on youth homelessness. Lara Law is the program director of YES, Youth Empowered Society. It's a drop-in center for young people in need. And Danny Jones is a remarkable young man who's here in the studio with us. He's a sophomore at Morgan State University, and he's now counseling other young people who are dealing with the challenges of homelessness the way that he did between the ages of 8 and 16. We'd love to hear your comments, your questions, your concerns about the problem of youth homelessness in Baltimore. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We're going to be back after a break. Stick around. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, Dr. Jeffrey Kahn of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics joins me for a conversation about the issues that he and other bioethicists are grappling with. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick stops by with her weekly review. This week, we'll get her take on the current show at Baltimore's Center Stage, Les Liaisons Dangereuses. And looking ahead to Friday, the Celtic music trio Helicon will be live in our studio with a preview of their annual Winter Solstice concert. That's coming up Friday on Midday. If you've just joined us today, we're talking about the pernicious and challenging problem of youth homelessness. The ABLE Foundation has just released a report entitled No Place to Call Home. Megan Lucy wrote that report. She joins us from the studios of KUCI in Irvine, California. Danny Jones is a sophomore at Morgan State University majoring in psychology. He spent about 8 years as a child and young teenager dealing with the fact that he often had no secure place to stay. We're also joined by Lara Law, who is the program director at Baltimore's only drop-in center and temporary shelter focused on young people. It's called Youth Empowered Society. It's in Charles Village. You are welcome to join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So when folks hear the little bits that they've heard so far of your story, Danny, the first question is, how did you turn it around? How did you end up being a college student at one of the most prestigious HBCUs in the country? You're 16 years old, and you ended up at a place called Loving Arms. Mm. Tell us about that and the transition then that happened from the time you connected with them.
Yes. Yeah, so the reason I actually got connected with Loving Arms is because it was like a certain period of time in my life where this was happening to all my family. Like, this is like a generational thing. Like, the fact that I turned it around is like amazing. It's because I'm the last one.
But it really is.
Yes. I'm out of 14 children. We all been through the exact same thing. And it was pretty normal, honestly. As a child, just like observing it, it was pretty normal. But I start feeling that I listened to my gut. You know, I listened to that intuition, you know, inner being, whatever it's called. And I reached out for help. It was a teacher. It was a teacher at a school called Crystal Ray.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Sure. Crystal Ray, yeah.
Yes, I reached out to a teacher. And first thing she did, because
that's a Jesuit school in South Palmer.
Exactly. She she helped me. She helped me get my glasses because around that time I didn't have no contacts or glasses, and I was roaming the street. I was still living how I was living, but I couldn't see at the same time. I didn't have no glasses.
Even when you were going to school, it was tough to see the board.
Exactly.
Figure out what was going on.
Oh my God! Yeah, you know, I couldn't see neither. So I just told about that, and she was just asking like, why your mother? You know, why can't your mother get it? Why? You know, I would start making up excuses, but then I end up, you know, breaking, like, you know, I'm homeless. You don't have to do it, but I would really appreciate it if you can. So after she...
So you sort of came clean to her.
Yes.
You sort of just told her, look, this is what's really going on.
Yes. And after she was able to do that, then she started looking at other things for me. And she found Loving Arms and she presented it to me. It took me a while to actually agree to go on, but...
And Loving Arms is... the only, as far as I know, overnight residence for homeless youth.
Exactly.
And Lara Law, explain to me why Loving Arms and places like that, even around the country, have, in many cases, a 21-day limit. I mean, you can be there for like 3 weeks, and then you're supposed to leave. Mm-hmm. Why is that? I mean, obviously, there's a whole lot of folks who can't get things turned around in 3 weeks.
Right. I mean, their goal is to reunite youth with their families. I mean, and they do a lot of work to help stabilize the family environment. And, you know, Danny's situation was really challenging, you know, and that may have not have been possible in his situation. And how long? So did you end up staying there a lot longer?
3 months.
Yeah.
So they sort of bent the rules a little bit.
Bent the rules all the way, man.
Yeah.
I think that's really common, and that Loving Arms and other shelters like that do what is needed to help make sure youth are going to be transitioning into stable situations. So if it's not the parent, then maybe it's an aunt, then maybe it's someone else, or in Danny's situation, a family friend,
yes.
that can support them long term, and especially until they can rent their own, because they can't in Maryland under 18, and. It's unfortunate. It's not enough time, but it's needed with so few resources. If it's the only one, we've got to be able to serve the next youth.
Sure. And they only have 8 beds.
Right. Yes.
Right? I mean, it's a small place.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they also have like blow up beds too, mm-hmm. just in case, you know, emergencies.
But it's not like there's, you know, 150 people staying there. I mean, it's a handful of folks.
Exactly.
Right. And so you were at Loving Arms for 3 months. You're
yes,
still 16 years old.
Yes.
So then what happened?
After Loving Arms, I was connected with a source, and after I stayed at this specific place for like a certain amount of time, it was a comfortable environment. I was able to, you know, just like reflect on life and see what was going on and see what was wrong, and I could actually see my family in a different light rather than always having an opportunity to run and, you know, trying to be Superman and, you know, say don't do this, don't do that, and internalizing the whole situation, you know. So that
because being homeless and sleeping at the bus stop and not knowing where the next meal is coming from was normal for you. And so when you're in Loving Arms, that's an environment in which that became normal, where
exactly.
you had meals every day, you had a good place to sleep, it was safe. And you sort of turned around you became hip to a whole new normal.
Definitely.
Yeah. And Megan Lucy, why is it that in 2011, 5 years ago or so, when they did the census of homeless youth, it was so much lower a number than it is in this report that you've just published? I mean, it went from like 640 to 1421. Is that because the methodology was different, or does this indicate that the problem is increasing with every passing year?
I do think it's a little bit of both, to be honest. The methodology was definitely different in that the 2011 data that was collected by the Johns Hopkins University was a parallel point in time count, which is meant to parallel the HUD point in time count that occurs in January. And the problem with point in time counts is, one, that it occurs during a single night. So it's only a snapshot of that one night. And two, it occurs in January when many people aren't going to be on the streets anyways because it's cold. And three, it's a count of shelters. And we know that for young people, they tend to avoid shelters at all costs just because there are no, with the exception of Loving Arms, there are no youth-specific emergency shelters for youth under 18. And for the youth that are over 18, most adult shelters aren't necessarily the most youth-friendly places, and young people will avoid them out of fear and discomfort for their safety.
Yeah, so Lara, that's a circumstance you're quite familiar with. I mean, it's dangerous to be in some of these shelters with the adults, isn't it?
It's certainly perceived that way. And if people have stayed there, they've had bad experiences, or they've heard from people that they've had bad experiences, and they just are so afraid of being preyed upon. They're also afraid of the stigma. Youth don't present as homeless. There's not, you can't tell, and they don't, you know, they're not a long-term alcoholic. They don't have mental illness that affects how they can relate with people. Which, you know, if people have been neglected for many, many, many years and are staying in those shelters, they're very different than them. And I don't think that's right for older adults either. But youth want their own. They'll really only stay in their own. So their own, a shelter that feels safe and comfortable to them. And instead, the youth who come to see us, who often don't stay at shelters, they tend to be on the older side. They tend to be about 17 to 25 for the most part. And they stay in abandoned buildings. Like Danny said, they stay at bus stops. They ride the bus all night or the train. Mm-hmm. They will stay in a car. They'll choose almost everything over that. And as the report, the ABLE report and the Youth Reach data shows us, they'll stay with strangers. They'll stay with people that they can't trust. They don't have the information to know to trust them. And often they have to exchange sex or food stamps or something to be able to stay there. And, you know, it's a crisis. We are helping people get into apartments and rooms to rent. And, I mean, that's the kind of support that we need is helping make sure they're in housing that they feel safe and supported in.
Lara Law is the program director at YES, the Youth Empowerment Society in Charles Village. Danny Jones is a student at Morgan State University. He's here with us in the studio. Megan Lucy is the author of a new report commissioned by the ABLE Foundation called No Place to Call Home. Our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780, our email address midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So, Danny, you're also now counseling other kids, young kids, who are having the same kinds of incredible challenges that you had when you were little. You're 21. You're not little.
Yes.
But you ain't old either. You know?
Right, right.
But when you talk about your experience finally talking to that teacher at Cristo Rey and sort of, you know, letting your guard down a little bit and saying, okay, I got to get you up to speed on what's really going on in my life. That was difficult to do, wasn't it? I mean, it wasn't your inclination to do that. Do the kids you're talking to have that same inclination even with a guy like you?
Yes and no. Not literally to me, but to, like, other staff members who are trying to get information out of them. The reason I'm able to get them to express it a little bit more easier, because all I have to do is internalize the situation, and all I have to do is, like, almost like, you know, an actor before they go into, you know, acting, they have to go inside their mind and, you know, play out feelings and stuff like that. So for me, it's really, I can relate to how that feels. So I usually try to put it in their perspective and try to put myself in their shoes and just express that I've been there before. So it's a little bit easier for me because I can't.
As opposed to a staff member or counselor or something, they know that Danny's been through this.
Yes.
Yeah, and that goes a long, long way in that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
What do you tell them?
I basically tell them, like, I show them, like, different scenarios at the end of, you know, at the end of the journey, you know, like, I show them, like, I ask them about their life, their family members, and do they know anybody that inspired them? And, you know, most of them look up to a lot of celebrities, and most of them look up to a lot of people that's in their neighborhood who aren't always, you know, positive influences. But I just show them, like, the ending to, like, the end of the road for their two role models, you know, and just basically put it in perspective. Like, it was easy for me to just say, man, I'm done, and I could go ahead and sell drugs and, you know, act like a thug that I could never be. You know, I could go ahead and emulate how everybody else act, or I could make a decision to say, you know what, I honestly want different, so I'm gonna have to start acting different. If I wanted to be treated a certain way, I have to start acting a certain way. And I just showed, like, you literally can change it. Like, you don't really need, you know, you don't need nobody to grab you by your hand, and you could do it, you know.
Most kids need an adult to tell them that. Most kids need a mom, a dad, a guardian, an aunt, an uncle, a teacher, a coach, a minister. You figured that, you told yourself that when you were a teenager. How did you do that, man? I mean, it seems remarkable in every way that you had this sort of presence of mind, the equanimity to say, look, if I'm gonna turn this around, I gotta do this. I mean, you were literally alone. Your mom wasn't backing you up. Your dad wasn't backing you up. Many of your siblings were even out of your life and not backing you up. You did this all by yourself. How do you think you dug down and found the strength to do that?
That's a good question. And it really started, I think I had the blessing of being the last child and just observing every one of my siblings. And I always listened to my gut feeling, always. And when I was around, like, I was living with my other brothers and I would just watch how they act. And, you know, I noticed my mom say, hey, when you get 16, you can drop out. You got to put up with it now because we don't want to
drop out of school.
Drop out of school, you know. And I was like, wow, I want to drop out. He dropped out. I want to drop out. So it took, you know, the more I was growing up, and it just didn't feel like, I was basing everything off of how I felt, not off of what my mom said or my brothers. I was basing off how I felt. So from hanging with brothers and they all, you know, doing, you know, stuff that just don't feel right, I could never conform. It was just like, you know, I'm gonna go over here. So I had the blessing of looking at all their mistakes.
LB is on the line from Dundalk. LB, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Okay, thanks, Tom. One thing, I didn't really give it to the guy who was just talking, because I actually grew up in a very nice household and never had to worry about them problems. But for me, the people that you meet in the assistance centers are sometimes the first people that don't want anything from
Yeah, LB, I'm awfully sorry, man, but your phone is going out on us, so we can't hear you. So we're going to try. Why don't you hang up and call us back, and we'll see if we get a better connection, and we'll come back to you, LB. I apologize. We just can't quite hear you. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We're talking about youth homelessness. Megan Lucy, one of the things that your report makes quite clear, the report commissioned by the ABLE Foundation, is that the services that do exist for Baltimore kids who are homeless are woefully inadequate. I mean, we are really very much underfunded and understaffed when it comes to helping these children who have food and housing insecurity.
You're very correct with that. Unfortunately, there are far too few services that exist for youth experiencing homelessness in Baltimore right now. And for the services that do exist, there are often quite a few barriers that limit young people's ability to access them. We talked a little earlier about the legal definitions, which can limit access to services, but things like transportation barriers or a lack of cohesion across providers, and developmentally inappropriate programs make the existing service array limited as well. You know, we talked about it as well. Loving Arms is the only emergency shelter for youth under 18, and there are only 8 beds, and their stay is limited for the most part. AIR City Steps is another provider as well, and they're the only provider that provides youth-focused housing options for young people between the ages of 18 and 25. And they have 3 transitional and permanent housing programs. And while they're going to be increasing their capacity in the upcoming year, every single day they have a wait list of 60 to 80 youth trying to access housing through their programs. pretty much every program that is there for young people experiencing homelessness in Baltimore City are consistently at capacity.
Danny Jones is a student at Morgan State University. Lara Law is the program director at Youth Empowered Society. Megan Lucy joins us on the line from Irvine, California, from the studios of KUCI. She's the author of a new report commissioned by the Able Foundation called No Place to Call Home. I'm Tom Hall. You can join us after we take a quick break. 410-662-8780 is our number here on Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We got a couple of calls to take, and we welcome your questions, comments, and concerns. Stick around. And I'm glad you're with us here for Midday. I'm Tom Hall. In 2011, researchers estimated that there were about 640 homeless youth under the age of 25 on the streets of Baltimore. The most recent estimate suggests that more than 1,400 young people don't always know where they're going to sleep, how they're going to eat on any given night. If you've just joined us, we're talking with Danny Jones, a young man who experienced homelessness for many of the years that he was growing up. He's a student at Morgan State University. He's with me here in the studio along with Lara Law. She's the program director at Youth Empowered Society, or YES, Y-E-S. They run the city's only drop-in center geared towards young people. Megan Lucy is a freelance journalist who wrote a report on youth homelessness for the Able Foundation. It's entitled No Place to Call Home. She joins us on the line from the studios of KUCI in Irvine, California. You are welcome to join us as well, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. LB in Dundalk, let's give this another try, man. How's your phone sounding these days?
Okay, can you hear me okay, Tom?
That's better. That's much better.
Excellent. Okay, first, you got to compliment that young man. He's an interesting study of nature versus nurture. I don't know which. But I often have the same problem of trying to explain to others how it happens. And it just seems like certain people want help and will take direction. And it seems like in Baltimore right now, we're just overwhelmed with the numbers of you know, kids out there. And it's hard to find the ones that truly want, you know, want help versus those that are just either gaming the system or making it hard for the others to get through. It's just it's a tough time in Baltimore, and I love this city. I grew up here. My story is exactly the opposite of his, but I still wound up in the same place. So it can happen to anybody, I guess is my message. And just for those that are out there working, just
so when you say, LB, when you say that your story is the opposite of Danny's, that means you grew up in a comfortable environment, but you still yourself ended up on the streets for part of the time?
Exactly. I never had to worry about a meal or a roof over my head or electricity. Any of the things I've heard numerous others yeah, I've been in a lot of halfway houses, not halfway houses, but transition houses and programs. And like I say, it's finding someone who believes in you. I think you got to do it for yourself, but you need those people out there. And the people that are out there working, they're usually the first people you find that are actually there to help you and not trying to take something from you. The streets are just very, very hard. And like I say, I'm grateful that I survived. It's hard to explain how sometimes.
Yeah, for real. How you doing now, LB?
Well, I'm living in a subsidized apartment in Dundalk. Living on $750 a month and doing great. Actually, I'm just very grateful.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, LB, and I appreciate the call. And appreciate your sharing the story. So, Lara Law, he brings up an interesting point that and I think there are a lot of folks who are very much disconnected with the actual realities that young people like Danny and others experience. Where they talk about kids gaming the system. There's this notion that there's all these people, and this goes back 30 years. I mean, during the Reagan administration, we had the notion of welfare queens and all that kind of stuff. do you ever see that? I mean, do you ever witness kids or the people who are working with them somehow trying to rip off the system?
I just don't think that's possible with this population. I want to start by saying that one of the best practices that we use in Loving Arms and other programs who work with youth who are experiencing homelessness uses is called harm reduction. And that means we meet people where they are. We don't expect that they'll stop either using drugs or they'll stop engaging in harmful activities just to walk in our door. So we meet them where they are. We build relationships with them in whatever they're doing. If we don't say you shouldn't panhandle, we shouldn't say we don't say don't have unprotected sex. We ask them questions about what they're doing. We help them think through and try to make better decisions. But we meet them where they are, and we work with them over the long term so that they can get stable. We've worked with somebody since we opened 4 years ago who it took him 2 years. The opposite of what the caller said, it took him 2 years to get over his pride and to accept that food stamps would help him as a first step, and then to take advantage of a shelter, and then to do a work training program. Now he's working and he's going to get his own unit soon. But it was this whole long period that required this approach of harm reduction. And we just believe in people through the whole process.
Mary in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. You're here with Lara Law and Danny Jones and Megan Lucy. Thanks
Hi, Tom.
For your call. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. What's on your mind today?
I was curious from Danny's perspective, what sort of things people in the community might do that would be helpful to the 8 youth who live at Loving Arms for short term? Is it transportation? Is it books? Is it tutoring? Is it warm coats? Is it nice meals being brought in? I don't have a feel for what from the participants. Yes.
All right. Well, we've lost Mary, but we got the gist of her question, Danny. I mean,
yes.
You're counseling kids at Loving Arms. You're still very involved with them. They were obviously a very, transformational organization for you when you were a teenager.
Yes, sir.
What can Loving Arms use when folks in the community want to help?
Really, just anything like she said, basically everything that she named. Like, the best thing would be to really to come and show face and just show that you care. And you know, something, bring pots and pans, you know, jackets and snacks. Sometimes just even like a 30-minute session just talking to the youth and allowing them to, you know, talk about themselves, you know?
Yeah, just paying attention a little bit. Did you ever have a mentor?
Man, you know, Miss Cindy Williams was the closest.
And she's the one who runs Loving Arms.
Yes, sir. She was the closest thing to a mentor that I ever had in my life. She was like a really big inspiration on, you know, just looking in the mirror and being able to, you know, express myself in a way where I don't have to, you know, be angry and, you know, certain things like that. And just looking at her and her telling me that and looking at the type of person she is made it easier for me to listen to her.
Would you like a mentor now?
Man, I would love a mentor now.
Yeah. What kinds of things do you think you might be interested in when you graduate in a couple of years?
Man, right now, I'm really interested in like real estate. I'm really like I've been reading about it. You know, I learned a lot about it. I've never been out in the field at all, but I'm really into it, and I've been looking for a mentor for like a couple months now. And if I could get one, I would work for him. I would shine his shoes. I would do absolutely anything. I think I'm close to obsessed with it.
Yeah. All right. Well, folks, if you're in the real estate business, there's a very remarkable young man here sitting across the table from me who would be delighted to meet you. So we will have the address, by the way, of and the contact information for Loving Arms on our website, WIPR.org/midday. LH in Towson, thanks for your call to Midday. Welcome to the show.
Yes. I'd like to draw to everyone's attention the remarkable program that I came in contact with last week, Westport, Connecticut, when I attended the funeral of a homeless woman, sponsored by this group. It's called Homes with Hope. Their website is hwhct.org. Their premises for every suburb of 25,000 people or more, if they would partner with a city, as Westport did with Bridgeport and Norwalk did with Stanford, they could house 100 people, and a major dent would be made in matter of homelessness. So I'm hoping the people that we have today, and thank you all for your presentation, it has been most informative, might check out Homes with Hope.
All right. Well, thanks for that suggestion. I appreciate the call. Megan Lucy, your report does outline several examples around the country of cities that are dealing with this issue with varying degrees of success. What are the ones that stand out to you as models that perhaps Baltimore could use as a paradigm?
Oh, that's a great question. I would actually focus more on the National Network for Youth's tool for evaluating a community's array of services for young people that are experiencing homelessness. And instead of looking to other, while it's important to look to other cities and programs, I think it's also incredibly important to ground whatever efforts that we're doing here in Baltimore City in the needs of the youth and service providers in Baltimore. And the National Network for Youth has a really great tool for helping evaluate the existing service array and where there may or may not be gaps, both in terms of the types of services, but also in terms of where along the spectrum of services, such as preventative services, more immediate or intermediate services and long-term services. But one place to look, it's not necessarily a particular program, but I do want to highlight Oregon. The legislature there invested $1 million, which in the grand scheme of things actually is not that much money for an issue of this size, but they invested $1 million to local communities who had to match some funds to help them create a comprehensive service delivery program that matched the specific needs in their community. And I like highlighting Oregon because the research on this investment is some of the more extensive research out there. And it really goes to show that there are cost savings for investing in youth homeless services. Mm. And in Oregon, they found that most communities found a $4 savings for every dollar invested.
Yeah. And Lair Law, it starts, Megan makes the point in her report, it starts with getting stable housing. Mm. If you don't have stable housing, none of the other stuff matters. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got to have a secure, yeah, safe place to live. You've just recently gotten some funding for a rapid rehousing pilot program. So where do you find the housing for the kids that you're helping out at YES?
With real estate, providers just like Danny is looking for. We're partnering with folks in real estate that are open to what we're doing and often supportive. There's a lot of people in the community that want to contribute in any way that, in some way that they can. And what we do is we provide the security deposit, and we're providing with this program up to 9 months of rental assistance that the youth contribute a third of their income towards the rent. And sometimes when they enter the housing, they often don't have income. But as we're working with them to get employed, then that starts to come in, and then we're able to support them. And we have to provide them a sense of case management and support, sure, to get used to that. Sure. And
well, that's all the time we have. Danny Jones is a sophomore psychology major at Morgan State University and a young man with a very, very bright future. Sir, it is an honor to meet you. I really appreciate your
time. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Lair Law is the program director at Youth Empowered Society, or YES. That organization runs the city's only drop-in center geared towards young people. Lair, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Megan Lucy is a freelance journalist whose report on youth homelessness for the ABLE Foundation is entitled No Place to Call Home. We've got a link to that report and more information about YES on our website, as well as information about Loving Arms, WYPR.org/midday. Thank you, Megan Lucy. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's it for us today. Tomorrow, Dr. Jeffrey Kahn of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics joins me for a conversation about the moral and ethical dimensions of research and technological advancement. For example, if a self-driving car is in an accident, should it be programmed to minimize injury to the occupants of the vehicle or to the pedestrians outside the vehicle? Jeff Kahn will help us frame the questions that we should be asking about that kind of stuff. Plus, Les Liaisons Dangereuses, a spicy tale of sex, power, and betrayal, is at Baltimore's Center Stage. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick has a review. By the way, coming up Friday on Midday, Helicon, the internationally acclaimed Celtic music trio, will be live in our studio with a preview of their annual Winter Solstice concert. And lunch for our guest today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies, with locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the Square in Canton, 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. All of us at Midday savor the sweet fact that you have tuned into our show today. I really appreciate it. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.